We have a huge agenda. So welcome everyone. This is the Wildlife Committee of the Washington Fish and Wildlife Commission. And I'm gonna reverse the order of the agenda. We have a couple of items that were added that won't take as much time. Our main item is the chronic wasting disease monitoring and response plan, long awaited, we want to spend a lot of time. This is our deep dive, so we want to have time for that. But first, I'm going to ask Mick Cope to give us a short update on where we are with the issue of the Hunter Points for the disabled folks. You'll remember that in 2010, there was a switch in the system and points were distributed to all categories. And we needed some more information before we make any recommendations to the full commission about this issue that's been brought to us by the ADA committee. So Mick, if you would go ahead.
Yes, thank you. Good morning, commissioners and and everybody. I have been, thank you for the introduction on the issue. Just a brief, a little bit more detail, but very brief to know that, you know, when we need to look into this, it takes us to be able to get into our database, our license sales database. And so I've been working with our licensing department to try and get some information that gives kind of a scope around what the scale of the issue is. And so I've asked them some questions and they've been able to get back some answers. And then I asked them a few more questions and we don't have all the answers back yet. So I'm not able to give kind of the complete picture here, but I can share what we have now and kind of the next steps here. So what we asked to begin with was just to kind of give us a picture of what in 2009, how many hunters had points, either in deer or elk, that were, as you said, distributed amongst all the categories in 2010 when we changed our special permit system. And the answer to that came back at 137,827. So over or almost 140,000 hunters had points. And as we talked maybe last meeting, the decision that went into, so there was a commission decision that created a rule that said how those points were going to get distributed. And those points got distributed equally. Say if a hunter had 5 points, they got 5 points in all of the new categories that were created because of the logistical nightmare that would have been to try and get a hold of 140,000 people and ask them what to do with their points. So when we created, say, quality bull or antlerless elk categories, if you had points, you got 5 points in all those categories. And also you've got points in the over 65 category and the hunters with disabilities category and also master hunter category, but may not have been, certainly not in that category at the time, but the programming at the time and the time it would have taken to get a hold of 140,000 people, it just was the decision at the time to make that kind of spread of points in each category. So we had 140,000 people at the time. Also at the time that the number of hunters who qualified for disabled hunter category in 2010 was just over 8,000, 8,084. Then thinking about, well, how many hunters have qualified for that disabled hunter category after 2010? And that was just under 5,000 at 4,964. So we have added, so that makes a total number of 13,000 hunters that are qualified as disabled or blind here in 2021. So through 10 years, we added about 5,000 hunters to that category, 500 a year on average. Today, that leaves about 125,000 hunters that have points in more than in one or more of the either disabled or senior or you know, in those other categories that haven't been used. They aren't eligible to apply for those hunts until they do become 65 or over or have a disability that puts them in that category. It's the part that we don't know yet, and we're still mining the data, is to know what our average number of points per hunter in either the 13,000 people that are currently in the disabled category, or what are the average number of points per hunter that are outside in the 124,000 hunters that haven't qualified yet. And like I said, those will all be in either disabled category or also in the senior category. And so that kind of adds a little bit of a twist to the discussion. So we're still gathering that information and want to present the committee with a little write-up on that when we get all of the data. That's kind of the current state of affairs.
Thanks. Are there any questions for Mick? So just to remind the committee and everyone that this, if we decide to proceed in any way, it will be looking at a rule. Mick mentioned that it's not just our disabled hunters, but also senior, and it would be also master hunters who enter after 2010 as well. So there are three categories that are impacted by this situation. So thanks for the update. The ADA committee is very interested in this. It is discussed at their meetings, and we've been trying to keep them up to date. So I wanted to get this information before the committee so that they could hear as well. So appreciate all the effort that's going into this. It's a complex issue. Mick. So now I'm going to turn to Cynthia Wilkerson. We have on our commission agenda tomorrow LANDS 2020. We're going to talk about the process and what we're looking at for this year, LANDS 2020. There are a couple of pieces in Region 6 that are requiring some relationship building with the local community there. And so Cynthia is going to kind of update us on that, and we'll have a short discussion about maybe strategy moving forward. So Cynthia?
Thanks, Commissioner Thorburn, and morning, everyone. And I know that we've got Larry Phillips on and Brian Calkins, and I know Cassina Lee is having some problems getting on, but she says she's on the phone. So just wanted to, again, in advance of tomorrow, just remind you where we are in the process and let you know kind of the status of the ongoing conversations and how that's going to inform the conversation tomorrow. So you'll recall that we've got 6 projects, 4 on the east side of the state and the 2 that, as mentioned, are in Region 6. You have the materials that are the public comment piece. And we had received 267 total public comments, and the vast majority, over 87% of those, were positive. There are some outstanding letters of concern and in opposition. So just flagging where we are in the status of those conversations, and in particular, as mentioned, the Chehalis Wildlife Area expansion project has generated some good conversation with the local community, and in particular, the status and the impact on an existing dairy and the concern in the community with regards to the impact on agriculture and the impact of DFW ownership, and does that make sense and how does that make sense? And so we've been having good conversations obviously, you know, the landowner is in a position, came to us, is interested in wanting, you know, to divest of that property. And we're having conversations with the conservation district and with the county. And we'll continue to be committed to that, those conversations, which, you know, this is in the floodplain. And so there's some potential for our interest to be able to shift and trying to figure out if there's a way to adjust some of those boundaries to address some of the concerns or what that looks like. But my overarching message with regards to where we are with this process is just a reminder that Lands 2020 is the process by which we look at a potential project and ask questions about the fit for the department, have some initial dialogue with the community, and then we determine through the initial approval from the director whether or not we're committed to continuing to explore the opportunity. And so that's where we are with this one and with the next one I'll talk about as well. So just remember, you know, we're far from a done deal on these projects, and we're committed to working with the communities and just want that green light, looking for that green light to keep going and to be committed to the conversation and understanding the role of DFW in these landscape level elements that are moving in these places. So that is kind of the Chehalis Wildlife Area expansion piece. And I'm happy to entertain questions and more from Brian and Larry, but I think I'll go to the next one as well. And then we can see if there's any questions. That sounds good, Commissioner, thanks. The Centralia Mine Project, which is in Lewis and Thurston counties, 9,600 acres. This one did generate the most comments of all of them. And it did generate some of the outstanding concerns and opposition. I would flag for you two components that are kind of at play here. One is the relationship that in particular Lewis County has and the expectations that they have with regards to their relationship with TransAlta, the coal mine that is there, that is transitioning out of coal mining and looking for other provisions for those lands. There's been a little bit of confusion about the actual footprint of what we're going for, and that we're not looking to take over the power plant. The industrial park at TransAlta lands that were given to the community by TransAlta for industrial development are not part of what would be donated. If we were to ever have a role in those lands, that would only be if they were willing sellers. TransAlta is also keeping the portion in the northwest of their property that is they're exploring for solar. So there's a lot at play in what the future of these lands could be. And I would say we're pretty early in the conversation about what it looks like, but fundamentally, you know, we have talked about this before in this committee about the incredible resource that this is and the opportunity to utilize, you know, have these lands function for conservation and for recreation in the part of the state, Western Washington, where there's a lack of this kind of larger area for recreation. So we see great value. There's this issue with the expectation and the industrial zoning. Industrial zoning comes with a tax bracket that, frankly, we can't compete with in terms of our PILT. And so there's, you know, a conversation about the expectations of the community and their future and the economic what they are looking for there and how does a wildlife area fit in with that. So that is something, there's conversations with the community and TransAlta that kind of need to happen. And we are looking to kind of create space to allow those conversations to play out. And the other major thing that we are hearing from all the comments, which you have and are free to peruse at your leisure, is the concern over endangered species, because we have, identified that these lands pose a significant value for reintroduction potential of Western pond turtle, Oregon spotted frog, and streak-toed lark. And so this has caused some concern about the impact of that on potential development in the region and adjacent lands, especially, you know, having past experiences with endangered species and the impact on industry and development. So we are working to, you know, kind of have conversations about the reality of what the work on those species and recovery of those species would mean in terms of actually the recovery on public lands, providing relief on private lands for the obligations associated with regulations, and also are the tools available to us through the ESA that are protective for landowners adjacent, like safe harbors, like candidate conservation agreements with assurances, like the ability to use the 10J experimental population under the ESA when we introduce other species of some of these species. So when and if, which we're a long ways from the when and if on this project. And there's a whole conversation that the other piece, I guess I would say we've heard from the commission and from others is a concern over the condition of the land and what responsibility we may be taking on, seeing that it was a former coal mine. And the obligations that TransAlta retains throughout the process are managed by the Federal Office of Surface Mining, and they are required to reclaim those lands and for them to be, you know, left in a position or condition better than or equal to what it was before they did the mining. So we don't take on those obligations. There's also quite a bit of nuance in the timing of even in the case of donation, which they're looking potentially of donating 6,500 acres, there's quite a long timeline of their continued obligation and that they would have to be managing for likely several years into the future. And that it would be quite a while before we would even take on some of those O&M pieces. So the long story short, knowing that you are on a tight schedule, is we are very engaged in conversations with the communities. We've had some great conversations with St. Sue, Centralia. You'll note letters from cities. So opposition certainly from the county, opposition from a series of the cities in Lewis County that was based on a letter developed by the county. And then two letters of concern and opening up the door for conversation from cities of Chehalis and Centralia. With that, and just also flagging that we did get quite a lot of letters in support of the project from Lewis County residents. And by our count, that was 49 positive and 9 negative from actual, you know, just residents writing in for our lands 2020 process. And that's Lewis County. Thurston County was 24 positive, 1 negative. So a lot going on, a lot of work and coordination and dialogue and a ton of work to come into the future. And like I said, we're looking for feedback and interest and concerns, but fundamentally, the green light to keep going and to keep you all in the loop as we move forward.
Thanks, Cynthia. Jim first, and then Lorna.
Yes, I'd like to address the Chehalis proposal. You know, I understand where we're at in the process, and I respect that, and I think that we need to allow our process to work the way it's designed. Having said that, I'm pretty sensitive to the issue with regard to the agricultural land being acquired by the department as perhaps the first choice. I think there may be some alternatives here that could be that could contribute and be very valuable to meet the department's objectives, and at the same time continue to allow that land to be functioning in an agricultural state. Just a little context is I live on property here in agricultural land. We have family property, and we lease out a significant portion of our property to the one and only dairy farmer left in Pierce County. And if he didn't have access to properties like mine, I don't have a stream, fortunately, or probably all maybe as valuable as is this. If he didn't have access to property like mine and others, he would no longer be in operation. And so it isn't just an impact on a particular parcel of land or a particular operation, but it can be significant in terms of to the community. And you know, I look around and I see, you know, all this used to be farmland now being developed, and while this may be a different site and could not have the houses, it could be transformed. And so I just support the idea of maintaining agriculture, because I don't see that agriculture by itself is inconsistent with our mission. So I think we just need to be looking at real options here as we go forward.
Say anything before Lorna?
Oh, just thank you. I think we're very much, you know, thinking along the same lines, and I'm very cognizant of, you know, not trying to overreach in terms of what role we can play in that, Commissioner Anderson. And, you know, it's really not our role to own lands and lease them for lease them for dairies. And so if the landscape level and community level conversation needs something different, then, you know, we are having those conversations about what's the right.
Thank you.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I didn't hear that you were opposed, but just raising right. The issues about what we need to look at as we move forward, which is exactly what we wanted out of this discussion.
Yes, that's exactly right. I'm not opposed, and my caveat was I believe that we have a process and we want to utilize that process, and it involves, you know, identification and study and outreach and engagement, and so that's all good, and I applaud the department for having that, and yet at the same time I, you know, kind of providing my perspective on how this needs to be considered.
Thank you. I see Brian, you have your hand up. Why don't you go, because I imagine it's in response to this before Lorna goes.
Yeah, thank you. just a little bit to add is that one of the things that we told the county commissioners when we met with them was part of the reason that this area is such good waterfowl habitat right now has been because of the agricultural use. And the easternmost portion of what we're looking to acquire that is currently part of that dairy is extremely wet. We've included other parts of the property, not knowing what the landowner is going to want to do. But if we were to acquire some of those areas that are not as wet, some form of agricultural agreement or management is quite likely what we would be looking at to maintain that waterfowl habitat quality. So it's not completely ruled out of the question if we acquire it, is what I was trying to point out.
Thank you, Brian. That's useful. Lorna, did you have something?
Yes. So here in Jefferson County, working with the local land trust, we have, you know, preserved a lot of farmland and wildlife habitat through using conservation easements, both for flood control and for riparian protection. So, and wetlands as well. So yeah, I would think that there might be a real benefit in looking at combining those tools to conserve that property. Otherwise, I'm very supportive of that project. And as far as the Centralia project goes, I'm very excited about that project. I just think it has tremendous, tremendous potential. And Cynthia and I have talked, about the need to do just really robust public involvement and outreach so that the community does understand, where the industrial lands are and that they can continue in that use. And then all the recreational potential and wildlife habitat that it probably will end up being an economic benefit for the community as well as a recreational benefit. So, I just think we can't afford to turn down this opportunity. So, very excited to work on both these projects.
You sense, Lorna, it's certainly the direction that we want to look at. I don't see any more hands. Thank you, Cynthia. As I said, our agenda is full, so I'm going to move it along then to our next topic. Before I introduce Malia, I'll just mention we also have a video of the predator prey study, something that we've been following for several years now, so that would be interesting. That will be after Malia's discussion with us, or presentation and discussion, we're going to have a lot of time for chronic wasting disease, so it may be optional if people want to stay, but just to give you a heads up, that is going to be available for us as well. So with that, I want to introduce Malia DeVivo, who is our ungulate scientist, and she's been working with a couple of her partners on a really important document that's been long awaited as we've watched chronic wasting disease, or CWD, come closer and closer to Washington. So Malia, with that, I'll turn it over to you.
Thank you. Let me fumble around here and share my screen.
Malia, do you mind if I jump in and give a plug to the team real quick before you get
started? Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
Yeah, so thank you. As Commissioner Thornburn mentioned, this is a very important issue, even before, we detect CWD. And the team here that put this plan together, they've just done an exceptional job. And I can't be more proud for the work that they've done on this, and excited to share it with the commission today.
Okay. Thanks, Brock. So we do have a lot to get through. First, good morning. As Commissioner Thornburg said, I'm the ungulate research scientist for WDFW. Today I'll be talking about chronic wasting disease and specifically our management plan. My slides are not advancing. There we go. First, I just want to acknowledge my co-authors, Kristen Mansfield, our wildlife veterinarian, and Sarah Hansen, our ungulate specialist with Game Division. I'm really proud to be part of this group with all of our experience in wildlife disease ecology and deer and elk game management. I think we've put together a really great document, and I'm excited to share it with all of you today. So do have a lot to get through. This is our agenda for this presentation. So first I'll give a really brief background about CWD and its history. And then we'll narrow in and talk a little bit about our past and present CWD surveillance in Washington State. The bulk of this presentation will focus on our draft CWD management plan. And then I'll end with a quick summary and some updates about the plan. And then hopefully we'll have a lot of time for questions and discussion. So first off, CWD is a transmissible spongiform encephalopathy. I know that's a mouthful, so I break it down here. So this is a disease that is transmitted from an infected animal to a susceptible animal. It's spongiform because it affects the brain. And so when you look at the brain microscopically, it looks spongy because the disease actually causes what are called vacuoles or holes in the brain. And obviously this is a disease of the brain, so it's an encephalopathy. The disease-causing agent is called a prion, which is a misfolded protein. So prions are ubiquitous to mammals. So we have prions proteins within our own cells. What happens in TSCs is that prion protein misfolds and causes disease. So some other well-known TSCs that you might have heard of are bovine spongiform encephalopathy, more commonly known as mad cow disease. And that disease is actually zoonotic. So humans can become infected when they consume the meat of cows that are infected with BSE. Creutzfeldt-Jakob disease affects people, and scrapie affects domestic sheep and goats. So that's just a really short list of other TSCs that you might have heard of. All these diseases are 100% fatal, and there are no vaccines or treatments for any of them. So specifically, CWD is a disease of cervids, so those species within the deer family. We do know that in the wild, we've documented CWD in moose, elk, mule deer, and white-tailed deer in North America, and reindeer, most recently in Norway. So CWD was first discovered or detected in a research facility in Colorado. It was first described as a wasting syndrome in captive mule deer and black-tailed deer that were part of a nutritional study. It wasn't until 1980 that the late Dr. Beth Williams actually classified it as a TSE. And soon after that, they found it in wild deer and elk in both Colorado and Wyoming. So prior to 2000, CWD was found in wild cervids in only 4 states and captive cervids in 1 state and 1 province. But by 2002, CWD had moved east of the Mississippi River to Wisconsin. And since then, currently it has been found in 26 states and 4 Canadian provinces. So CWD is transmitted through infectious materials that contain the disease prion. And deer can shed disease prions within their saliva, urine, and feces. CWD prions have also been found in cervid antler velvet. We've also detected it in fetal tissues, as well as in skeletal muscle and blood. The highest accumulation of prions are typically found in lymphoid tissue and central nervous tissues, so the brain and spinal cord. And that is why the typical samples that we take from dead deer and elk are lymph nodes of the head and neck, as well as the brainstem. So CWD can be transmitted both directly from infected animal to susceptible animal, as well as indirectly through contaminated environments. So as infected animals shed those prions in either their saliva or urine and feces, they contaminate the environment with those prions, and other animals can come into contact with that on the landscape. Another way that the environment can be contaminated is decomposing carcasses. So where those infected animals lay, those areas become contaminated with prions. So this is a picture of an open carcass pit in eastern Washington with a bunch of deer carcasses. So some other concerns relate to if this disease is zoonotic or not. So evidence to date and the research that has been conducted with CWD suggests that it is not zoonotic, unlike bovine spongiform encephalopathy. However, the CDC and WHO recommend not consuming CWD positive animals. And that's because we'd still like to keep this disease out of the human food chain and not allow it to potentially become zoonotic to humans. Another concern is other non-servant ungulates. So CWD has not been detected in bighorn sheep, mountain goats, and pronghorn, as well as domestic cattle, sheep, and goats. As far as detecting it in wild ungulates, that is mostly opportunistic sampling. So when CWD was first discovered, researchers also tested these species. For domestic animals, they have conducted laboratory studies, so actually trying to force an infection and inoculate these animals. And fortunately, they found that there's enough of a species barrier where these animals do not develop CWD. So as wildlife managers, the reason why we're concerned about this disease is that research has demonstrated that CWD can cause significant declines in deer and elk populations. And this research has been conducted in Wyoming and Colorado. And so Ryan Minello, he produced a really nice graph showing how the increase in CWD prevalence in adult female elk, after about 11% prevalence in the population, you start to see the population growth rate decline below stability below one. So we also demonstrated this in Wyoming white-tailed deer and mule deer. And so what's happening here in all three species is that prime age adult females are, their survival is significantly reduced when they're infected with CWD. And so therefore that translates to population declines in the long term. So let's focus specifically in Washington. So in the we began CWD surveillance in 1995 of animals that presented with suspected signs of CWD, so clinical disease. In 2001, the federal government actually gave all states funding to expand their surveillance efforts. And so we were able to use that money to expand our surveillance statewide. So not just testing those animals that showed signs of CWD, but also systematically testing animals statewide. Unfortunately, after 10 years, the federal funds ended. And so the department had to revert back to just doing symptomatic surveillance of those animals that potentially had signs of the disease. So presently, we continue to do that systematic surveillance. And since we started testing animals, we've tested a little over 6,000 deer and elk and moose. And all those samples to date have tested negative for the disease. So unfortunately, though, while none of those animals tested negative, testing has been limited. So only those animals that show signs of the disease are tested. And so as of right now, we can't confidently say that Washington is in fact CWD free. As the name suggests, this is a chronic disease. So animals can survive months to years even, shedding those prions, and we wouldn't notice until the end stages of the disease. So those are the animals that right now we would potentially test. So we wouldn't take out those infected animals until much later in the disease progression. So we became increasingly concerned about this disease in 2019 when CWD was detected just 70 miles east of our border in Libby, Montana. And we have taken steps to reduce our risk of transmitting the disease to our state. But as I'll discuss in later slides, there are some other steps that we can take that will significantly reduce our transmission risk. So I'd like to pause here just to, before I get into our CWD management plan, just to see if there's any questions about the background or history or anything about the disease specifically that anyone has. Go ahead, Commissioner McIsaac.
Yeah. Yes, thanks. And let me say thanks very much for a very nice presentation. I have a question on slide number 10.
Okay.
Which was your slide showing a decline in the population.
Mm-hmm.
Very interesting slide here. The punchline seems to be that the more this CWD is found, that there is a decline in the population status because of that. What caught my eye was the 1.00, which I guess is where the population growth starts. And I see that kind of intersects the line out there at about 15 years. So And it's nice to see some confidence intervals on here and the rest of it, but just as a matter of a scientific conclusion, is there other things involved in the decline from 1.0 down to 0.975 or something like that in recent years that implicate the conclusion, or do you feel like the conclusion is really the soundest science that we have here?
Yeah, thank you for your question. I did a poor job of explaining this graph. So this actually is, on the x-axis is prevalence of the disease, so not years. And then this is the population growth rate. So if population growth lambda is one, that means your population is stable. And anything above one, your population is increasing. And anything below one, your population is decreasing at a certain rate. So what this is showing and what this researcher did was he found that keeping all else equal, if CWD is at a prevalence, I believe at 11% in this particular elk population, they began to see that the population growth rate declines below that stable rate of one. So I hope that clarifies your interpretation of this graph. Was I able to answer all your question?
Yeah, well, thanks. I didn't perceive it properly to begin with, but this is one population. This is not multiple populations that show this. Is that right?
Correct. Yes. So this graph is a populate. So this is related to a specific elk population in Colorado.
Yeah. Okay. Well, very interesting. And thank you again for the presentation.
Yeah. And so if there are questions about what some of these terms are, so prevalence is just the number of infected animals over the number that you've tested. So that might also help clarify what prevalence of CWD is. Go ahead, Commissioner Anderson.
Yeah, this maybe you answered this when you were discussing the zoonotic situation or factor, but the one of the thoughts I had is to what extent, you know, we hear about how predators may reduce population of certain populations, and they would go after diseased animals as an easy target, which makes sense. I'm wondering the extent to which there can be transmissibility of this or a continuation on passing on of the chronic wasting disease upon or after predation. So is there any kind of study or thought with regard to that?
Just for clarification, do you mean transmitting the disease to the actual predator or?
But I brought it both. So to the predator or, mm-hmm. you know, if the idea is that it's going to take away diseased animals and it only, and it doesn't do that, it just passes them through the system, then we're not getting any benefit there.
Okay, I think I understand your question. So as far as transmitting to other species outside of cervids, we have not, researchers have not detected the disease outside of the cervid family. So I don't know if people have actually tested carnivores or those species, but my knowledge is that those animals are not susceptible to this disease. It is just a deer disease, deer family disease. As far as research that has been done, looking at how predators, carnivores, facilitate transmission when they're consuming infected animals, there was research conducted with coyotes, and they found that they are able to break down and digest the prions, but they also will pass in their feces prions that are still infectious. So we don't know the implications of or what that actually means on the landscape. So while they're still there, they are in fact essentially cleaning some of those prions from the environment, and they are being degraded in their digestive tract. They can still pass infectious prions to other locations, but how that contributes to epidemics, we just don't know at this point.
Thank you.
Thanks. Lorna?
I guess in all of this, you know, one major, I won't say the only concern, but a major concern I have is I keep reading, and now we heard here today that both Center for Disease Control and WHO are recommending that humans, in an excess of caution, not consume animals that are contaminated, and yet hunters aren't going to know if they're contaminated, especially given the fact that these symptoms don't even show up for, you know, towards the end of the progression of the disease. So that's a scary, you know, that's a scary place to be as far as I'm concerned. How do we walk, you know, along that fine ridge there of, you know, people being, if a hunter goes on to the CDC site to say, oh, what are my concerns? And they see, oh, I'm recommending not to even, well, I'm not going hunting this year. You know, how do we deal with that? Given we don't have it yet, but it could be, you know, 70 miles away isn't very.
Yeah, so that's, I hear that concern. And yeah, that is a real concern. One thing that I didn't talk about is that we do have tests that are available, and which I'll talk about with our surveillance program. So hunters can get their animals tested. Those tests will pick up a positive animal, not all early positive animals, but they are very good tests. They'll pick up a positive animal prior to showing those clinical signs. So part of this conversation and our management plan, which I'll discuss here shortly, is our public outreach and education piece. And so getting that information out there to hunters, truly understanding the risks, and also what tools we can use to help them, you know, identify if their animal is an infected animal and what they should do after they get a test positive deer or elk. So I see a few more hands. I'd like to move on if I can, and if these questions can wait. I see Anise has his hand up, so maybe he has a comment.
Yeah, this is related to Commissioner Smith's question. So yeah, this is something that we certainly are concerned with as well, but realizing that this disease has been on the landscape for decades now in some states, and so they have learned to deal with it through testing and through education. And keep in mind, in those places, like I said, 30, 40 years, people, although initially reduced maybe hunting, eventually people became more comfortable with it. And to this point, to this time, we haven't seen a human case. And so, but it does take a long time. So some of these other brain diseases are that we may be diagnosing maybe this. So we want to be careful, I guess. But as far as hunters, how they react to it is it varies, and it goes through a whole series of steps. But eventually, I think people are comfortable hunting, especially if there's a good testing program. And the way that other states worked with it is basically you get your animal tested, and maybe you cut it up, put it in the freezer, and you don't eat it until you get the result back. And usually the result comes back within a couple of weeks or a month. So that's maybe some ways to deal with it. It's not foolproof, obviously.
No, and you know, the first time we get a case, it sounds like it's always fatal. So that sitting out there is, you know, it's not like it's gonna make you, you know, sick to your stomach for 48 hours. It's a fatal disease. So
go ahead, Commissioner Anderson, and then I'll move on after your question.
Okay, just responding to Commissioner Smith, and just maybe a way to look at this somewhat is that it's not too dissimilar to how we deal with shellfish, either PSP or domoic acid. There are, while we have better ways to assess that, it's often what part of the shellfish that you are consuming. And so I think with game is, you know, this is in certain areas of the deer and not in others. So there may be ways to that hunters and people that consume the animal can feel confident that by avoidance. But
okay. Yeah. Thank you. And I just like to say, you know, please ask more questions about the disease, because I truly believe that once you have a strong foundation of understanding how this disease interacts with our environment, our wildlife, and us, that's when you'll understand why we are proposing a lot of our management actions in our plan. So feel free to ask more questions about the disease after I'm done with discussing our plan. Okay, so for the remainder of the presentation, I'll talk specifically about our draft CWD management plan. I've already gone over the, you know, CWD background, so we'll skip right into the last four chapters. And so our first chapter we'll discuss is the public outreach and communication. The purpose of this chapter is to proactively build trust with and support from our public and stakeholders regarding our CWD management activities. As Commissioner Smith just pointed out, you know, this piece is crucial and critical to our success with our CWD management activities. And it affects all aspects of this plan. So we rely heavily on our public and our stakeholders throughout this management plan. So implementation of risk mitigation strategies, compliance with any CWD rules and regulations. We will rely primarily on our hunting public to submit samples. And there will also look to our public to help develop and implement management strategies after we detect the disease. So the strategy for our outreach and communication is based on phases of this plan. So right when we adopt it, we would like to establish a public advisory group, and this group will help to provide feedback on our risk mitigation and surveillance activities. And then long-term, we recommend implementing a human dimensions initiative. And so this initiative will help us understand the baseline public perception and awareness of CWD. And then why this is so important is because this will help guide our messaging during each phase of the plan. So the phases are pre-detection, so before we actually detect the disease, and then initial detection after we detect the disease in our state. So right now we have a schedule of communication and an outline of our outreach activities for each of these phases, as well as key messages for both our pre-detection and initial detection phases. So what's important to understand is while we have these messages within the draft document, they should be viewed as a living document, because hopefully with that human dimensions initiative, we will learn more about what our public is aware of and how those messages should go out. So we have what we believe at this time are important key topics to get out there, but that might change be updated based on what we learn from the human dimensions work. So our next chapter is our risk assessment and minimization. The purpose of this chapter is to identify the best management practices to reduce our risk of introducing CWD to Washington. And then I'll add also to reduce our risk of transporting within the state of Washington. So prevention is our best management practice. And as we pointed out, there's no vaccine, treatment, or cure for this disease. Prions are very persistent in the environment. They can persist for years to decades even. So prevention truly is our best management practice. The actions that we propose in this chapter are all based on AHWA's best management practices for CWD that they published in 2018. So within our state, we've identified four areas of highest risk of introducing the disease and spreading it. And those are live cervid movement, cervid carcass importation and disposal, feeding and baiting practices, and the use of urine-based scents and attractants. So I'll go through each of these with more detail. So the first one, live cervid movement, this does pose the greatest risk for introducing the disease. Our current regulations allow importation and transport of some captive non-native cervid species into and within Washington. We do also allow restricted relocation of native wild cervids within Washington by our department. So relocating moose from downtown Spokane to more suitable habitats, that's just one example. And we also allow transport of wild cervids for rehabilitation purposes. And generally this is mostly when people pick up fawns in the spring. So our recommendations are to, our preferred option is a complete prohibition of live cervid importation, possession, propagation, and trade within our state. Alternatively, though, we would recommend prohibiting importation of live cervids originating from states and provinces that are known to have CWD, as well as require that they enroll in the federal CWD herd certification. We would also recommend requiring a CWD monitoring program for all captive facilities, which we currently do not require at this time. Our next area of risk is carcass importation and disposal. Like I said, decomposing carcasses on the landscape are areas where they can contaminate the environment, and indirect transmission can occur. These areas if there's a bunch of carcasses, they can become what are known as hotspots for transmission. Our current regulations, we do actually restrict importation of whole carcasses in certain high-risk parts from states and provinces that have detected CWD in their wild cervid populations. What's important to note about this regulation, though, is we're constantly updating which states and provinces are on that list. And in fact, just this year, we added Ohio. Ohio actually did have positive cases in their captive facilities, but it wasn't until this year that they detected it in their wild cervids, so they were added to our list. Because of these delays in detection and then adding it to our list, and the fact that we only add those states that find it in their wild populations, our recommendation is to update the WAC to apply to all cervid species from any state, province, or territory, regardless if they have detected CWD and whether the cervid was captive or wild. And so just to expand on that too, for example, we are relying on other states to have a robust surveillance program to actually detect the disease. So if they do not, and they technically have not found the disease, but it does, again, just like our state, we cannot confidently say that we don't have the disease. So, and as far as captive or wild, it's more often than not that when a state finds it in a captive facility, they subsequently find it in their wild populations. So to emphasize this point and why this is such a high risk concern of ours is USGS produced this map of the home zip codes of hunters that harvested a deer in one of four counties in Wisconsin. And so what this map shows are hunters come from every state to go hunt in one of these four counties where we know that CWD prevalence is as high as 50% in those populations. So what this map does not show is how many of those deer that those hunters took home were positive. So this is just showing the home zip codes. So the potential of spreading the disease throughout the U.S. is pretty significant if you just look at this map. And that's only representing four counties in a state. Our next area of artificial feeding and baiting is artificial feeding and baiting practices. This increases both local densities of animals, as well as increases the environmental contamination as those animals congregate and shed those infectious prions. Our current regulations, there's actually no restriction on feeding, and there is a restriction on the amount and placement of bait during hunting seasons. So our recommendation is to ban baiting for the purposes of hunting and deer and elk, and prohibit recreational feeding by the public to significantly reduce our risk of transmitting this disease. And lastly, our area of risk is using urine-based scents and attractants. So as I mentioned before, CWD prions can be shed in the urine for potentially months to years before the animal shows signs of disease. By using these lures as well in the environment, we're potentially concentrating cervids and also creating CWD transmission hotspots, just like baiting and feeding. So our current regulations, there are no restrictions on the use of these scents and attractants, and deer urine production and sales in Washington are not regulated by any agency. I'll just This is a really important point. In Oregon, they found that even synthetic, what was labeled as synthetic deer urine, they actually found that some of those products did contain real urine. So to highlight that the production sales of that of those products are not regulated by any agency. So our recommendation is to prohibit the use or possession of urine-based scents and lures for deer and elk hunting. Okay, so the next chapter in our plan is our pre-detection surveillance. The purpose of this chapter is to outline our systematic surveillance strategy, which would be necessary to detect CWD early during an outbreak. And the reason why this is important is that if we can detect the disease at or below 1%, we really reduce the likelihood that this disease is spreading unchecked in our populations, as well as increases our the likelihood that our initial emergency response efforts will be successful. So again, our current surveillance is not sufficient to actually detect disease early during an outbreak, because we are only targeting those animals that would already present with clinical signs. So our surveillance strategy tries to optimize where and who we are taking samples from. So we look at geographic, species, and demographic risk factors associated with CWD. And so we have proposed that our surveillance takes place in Eastern Washington in what we identified as 9 CWD sampling units. The location of these sampling units is based on the proximity to known CWD cases, specifically near Libby, Montana. As far as species, we're looking at white-tailed deer and mule deer. And each sampling unit, we identify the dominant species, and that is the species we will target. Deer in general have much higher prevalence compared to elk and moose. So that's why we are targeting white-tailed deer and mule deer. Demographics, we have found that mature adult males tend to be CWD positive compared to younger animals and females. So that will be our priority, is to target those adult males to get those samples. And then also CWD positive deer are more susceptible to predation and roadkill. So trying to identify those carcasses and making those carcasses priority for sampling in those sampling units. So these sampling units, the 9 that we have proposed here on this map, are made up of either one or several GMUs. And the unit size within those sampling units is at or below about 15,000 deer. And the reason for creating those sampling units is that our goal is to detect CWD at or below 1% prevalence. So if each unit had 15,000 deer, to be 95% confident that we would detect CWD at or below 1% prevalence, then we would need to sample 300 deer from each sampling unit. We recognize that potentially this we won't be able to hit 300 deer per sampling unit. So we produce this graph to show at what level of confidence we would be at if we collected fewer than those 300 deer to detect CWD at or below 1%. So for example, if we collected only 150 samples, we would be 78% confident that we detected CWD at or below 1% prevalence. So these numbers are not arbitrary. Detection at 1% in a sampling unit of 15,000 deer means that about, we would expect about 150 deer to be infected with CWD at that time within that sampling unit. And so a lot of states are comfortable with that level of infection, and balancing between gaining control of the disease once it hits that level, as well as the resources and time it takes to actually collect that many samples. This tends to be the threshold that most states are willing to set that bar at. So it's not based on any sort of research, but it's based on what we feel is comfortable that we could actually respond to and have some control of the disease.
Malia, do you want to wait for questions at the end, or Jim Anderson has his hand up? Do you?
This is real.
Sure. Yeah. Go ahead.
Real quick question: why did you exclude Game Management Unit 121 from this, given the amount of harvest that's in that area?
Yeah, that's a good question. So, so based on our harvest, we identified that Game Management Unit 117 would be at that threshold of about 15,000 deer, and just balancing between with our, resources and what we could realistically collect, we felt that, you know, based on those risk factors and optimizing our surveillance strategy, we would focus our sampling in GMU 117. The idea here is that we believe that because it's on the eastern side of the border of the state, in theory, we would see CWD first show up in 117 before 121. Again, ideally, we would be able to sample the entire state, but this is based on those criteria to optimize our surveillance program.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm.
Sarah had her hand up, but took it down. So maybe you made the point, Malia.
Okay.
Sarah? Yeah.
Oh, yes,
Sarah. Yeah, you got it. And the other thing that I would mention is just based on movement patterns that are most common with whitetail deer, we should see it coming through the first unit before it gets to 121. So that should be a good guidepost there.
There, just a further question, though. I mean, you're sampling way out in Okanagan, which seems like it would be more difficult in like the northern tier to end up in the far left blue area. I don't have my glasses on, but then it would to show up in 121, for instance. So it almost seems like with that logic, you wouldn't be testing in the further reaches of the blue.
So, and Sarah, jump in. But based on, like Sarah said, movement patterns, so specifically of mule deer in that area, we are concerned with transmission from the north. So while BC has not detected CWD, Alberta has. So based on geography and the migration patterns of those species, we identified that that northern part of our state is at higher risk.
Okay.
Yeah, and I can back that up. With the white-tailed deer that are sitting in the Northeast, their movement patterns don't tend to be too expansive. We're talking in terms of maybe 8 to 12 miles for a larger movement. When you get into mule deer, especially in the north, in the Okanagan going up into BC, some of those animals can migrate about 47 miles. So during the summer, they're spending their time, they're moving all the way through the Satan wilderness, and they're actually spending a good amount of time up in BC, where we expect there's going to be some interaction with their migratory deer up there. So that's why the sampling units are set a little bit different for whitetail deer and mule deer. It's depending on the movement patterns that we see with those animals.
Thank you.
Okay, thanks. I'm just noticing our time, so I might speed up here. So the majority of our sampling will come from hunter harvested animals. So from check stations, we'll reach out to meat processors and taxidermists, hunting groups, damaged and special permit hunts, various collection sites where we might actually put collection bins so hunters can drop off their samples. And then also working with the tribes and collecting samples during tribal hunts. Again, vehicle killed cervids are high priority. So working with WSDOT, convenience samples are just those that when our staff is out and about and they see a hit deer or elk, that they have the resources and time to actually collect those samples. Salvage tag holders, collecting and submitting samples. Our focus, while it is in Eastern Washington for our systematic surveillance, we will continue to test animals that are reported as having clinical signs, and that effort will be statewide. And then we also work with researchers who are radio collaring cervids within our state and are investigating mortalities, collecting those samples, especially those animals that are killed by predators, because as we know with research, those animals are more likely to be susceptible to predation. All right, so for the last chapter and part of this presentation, I'll talk about our initial response, emergency response. The purpose of this chapter is to outline what our response is to an initial detection of CWD in Washington or within 10 miles of our border. Because essentially, if it's within 10 miles of our border, we should be concerned that it has actually already, it actually already occurs potentially within our state. The purpose of this is to prevent CWD from establishing and becoming endemic in our cervid populations. So the focus of our actions is to contain CWD to that area of detection and continue our efforts to mitigate the risk of further introducing and spreading the disease throughout our state. All of the strategies that we propose are outlined by OFWA's best management practices. And most specifically, we borrowed a lot from what Montana just recently updated their CWD management plan. We used a lot of what they have proposed in their plans and have learned a lot from them, actually. So part of the emergency response is to create an incident response team, which will carry out the initial emergency response. The response manager will be appointed by our director, and then the response team will be made up of various WDFW representatives from regional programs and divisions. And then we will also have external partner representation. So that's just, that's a list that we came up with. It's not totally inclusive. So there might be other partners and representatives that we identify based on where our first detection is that should be included in this response team. So our initial emergency response is broken up into three different phases. I'll go through each phase in the order that they should start during the emergency response, but you should know that there is some overlap with these phases. So the first phase is our initial response phase, or I like to think of it as our containment phase. So first we would define an initial response area, or IRA. And this is an area where we use a radius of approximately 10 miles that surrounds the initial detection. And within this IRA, we will mandatorily sample all hunter harvested and salvaged roadkill cervids. We would also define a transport restriction zone, or TRZ. The TRZ is a larger area that surrounds the IRA, and this is will help us restrict the transport of whole carcasses and unprocessed carcass parts outside of this zone. And the reason why this zone is larger and surrounds the IRA is to help hunters and people who salvage cervids within this area realistically get to a either a meat processor or a taxidermist or an area to properly dispose of their carcass. We also recommend that within the TRZ, rehabilitation of cervids is prohibited, and that rehabilitized cervids are not released within the TRZ. And then we would also want to evaluate and potentially terminate feeding and baiting practices within the TRZ if this is not already established prior to our first detection. So the next phase is the disease assessment phase. And in this phase, we are quantifying CWD prevalence and distribution. So we would randomly sample all cervid species, sex, and age classes within the IRA. So one thing to point out, this looks very different from our systematic surveillance where we're targeting those animals that would most likely test positive. So in this scenario, we are trying to get a random sample of everything, so that we can truly understand what the prevalence and distribution is of the disease in that area. So to collect these samples, we will make every attempt to first maximize hunting opportunities, whether by adjusting hunting season dates, adjusting antler point restrictions, or special permit opportunities. And then the last phase is our evaluation phase, which is self-explanatory, but basically in this phase, we will formally evaluate how the initial emergency response went and if we were successful by asking these questions as well as others that we identify. Some of these will be a lot easier to quantify and answer, such as were we able to collect enough samples to get prevalence and understand distribution of the disease. Potentially a little more difficult will be questions like, did we achieve public support through our actions? So this is where it will be really critical that we have that Human Dimensions Initiative in place so that we can actually measure and answer some of those questions in regards to public support and during an initial response. So lastly, we have to talk about captive cervid facilities. So if a positive captive cervid is detected, then our recommendation is to depopulation of the entire stock and testing. We do have, the department does have legal authority to do that. If a positive cervid is found in a captive facility, we would treat it just like a wild cervid. So we would implement the initial emergency response and create that IRA that with the center being the facility. If a positive animal is found at a zoo, the department will work with that zoo to determine the actual risk to our native wild cervids. So in summary, again, currently Washington has not detected the disease. However, we are only doing symptomatic testing, so limited understanding of what our true disease status is. Prevention is our best management practice. And doing that public outreach and education will really help us implement those mitigation strategies. Systematic surveillance is incredibly vital and will be the only way that we will be truly successful with our initial emergency response. We get this question a lot. What if we implement our surveillance and we immediately find that CWD is in fact here and more widespread? Nothing would change in our initial emergency response, our risk minimization and our public outreach. All those will be, it's still how we would respond to the disease, and it would be even more essential to hopefully gain control of it within our state. CWD is a major threat to the sustainability of our wild cervid populations, as a lot of research has demonstrated. And it does have direct and indirect impacts on our state resources and economies. So just a quick update. So we recently just received a lot of great feedback from external partners and tribes And based on those reviews, we identified some areas that we need to revisit within our plan. So just to make you aware that you might see some updates to our transport and disposal recommendations. So that's going to be a significant hurdle and issue that we need to have some dedicated conversations about, because disposal of potentially infected carcasses is and potentially hundreds of those in within one season is a huge feat that we really need, that we need to have some specific conversations about in the future. So we might have some updates in our draft plan in regards to transport and disposal. We also recognized and identified that working with our, with the tribes is essential on these issues, and potentially even having our own initiative with the tribe, with tribes in our state, because they do manage their servant populations and have tribal hunts. So collaborating with tribes is immensely important to us in tackling CWD issues and the management of the disease. We also identified that clarity in some of the timelines and the process of implementing a lot of these strategies. We might need some more language in the draft plan to really clarify what this looks like and how this will be how this will be carried on after we adopt the plan. And so we hope to have the draft plan out for public review by the end of April. So that's all I have, and hopefully I've left enough time for questions.
Thanks, Malia. That was great. Lorna, you had your hand up a while ago. Did you want to start?
Yes. I mean, I find the whole discussion, you know, it's alarming potential, and we certainly want to pull out all the stops to, you know, keep it out of the state. First of all, you know, are we cooperating with Idaho so that they can hold the line? Because if they hold the line, then, you know, we got a better chance at it. And are we, so that's one question. Are we checking carcasses that are coming in with hunters from states that, you know, have a prevalence of the disease? It just seems like we really have to up the game here. So you guys have done a great job putting this together, but it seems like a lot more resources are going to have to be, you know, brought to bear to keep this from getting into Washington, because that'll be, you know, that's the best situation we can hope for, is to keep it out of our state.
Yeah, I'll take the first stab at this, and I, you know, I'll let anyone else who wants to chime in go for it. But yeah, you've definitely identified that it will require a lot more resources. That public education and outreach piece is so critical, because we truly are relying on our hunting public to understand the risks and how to properly import their carcasses from other states. We do have that information out there, but we definitely need to do a better job at getting that out more widely and getting that piece of information out to hunters that are hunting out of state. We do respond to a handful of cases each year with hunters that are contacted by the state agency where they harvested their animal, that their animal did in fact test positive. Sometimes the hunters have imported properly, sometimes they have not because they were not aware. But we do respond to a handful of those cases and help the hunter dispose of that carcass properly. I'm sure other people, Brock has his hand up. Go ahead, Brock.
Yeah, I would just add that, so we do have a rule in place currently that requires hunters that go to states, you know, if they harvest an animal and they're notified that is CWD positive, we do have a rule in place that says they're supposed to notify us of that information. In addition, I believe most of the states that are doing testing, if they get a positive result, they do share that information with states that the hunter, you know, had residency in. So we've had some situations where the hunters were not aware of the requirement to contact us, but the state agency notified us that there was a Washington resident that came to their jurisdiction, harvested an animal, and it tested positive for CWD. So we do have some mechanisms in place that do help us, you know, bridge that gap of communication about CWD positive carcasses being transported across state lines.
But then do we reach out to those people? And then what do we do?
Yeah, so we follow up. Whether we make the initial contact or if it's the hunter that contacts us per the requirements, we, in most cases, have taken possession of that carcass. Everyone that I've dealt with, they're very open to that, and we coordinate that with them to make sure that it gets disposed of properly at an appropriate disposal facility.
So the order of hands was Fred, Molly, and Jim. So Fred?
Yeah, first of all, great presentation, Malia. Really appreciate it. Really well done and really shaping up. You know, from my perspective, it's not surprising that the first cases were in captive situations, because there you have, of course, the crowding of the animals. But the other weird thing about prions is that they're not living. They're not like bacteria. They're not living. And I guess they really can stay in the ground for decades. And so I have two questions about really sort of crowding of animals. The first is, I don't know the situation, if you could just give me a brief update on captive facilities other than zoos. Are there axis deer, for example, that are raised? Are there deer farms in Washington?
I'll let Kristen talk about this. She's more familiar with our captive situation. I know that the majority of our captive facilities are reindeer, but I'll let Kristen answer this. She'll do a much better job.
Oops, you're on mute. You're on mute, Kristen.
Good morning. Our WACs do currently allow reindeer farming and fallow deer farming. We do have a handful of reindeer farmers. I would say only three or four really. We also have a lot of fallow deer. Some aren't farmed, some are free ranging on very large pieces of property. And we do also know that we have some illegally held things like Sika deer and Axis deer. So the answer is yes, we do currently have captive servants. We don't have a very large industry, but we do have some, and we need to. One of our recommendations is to revisit those WACs and try to tighten those up for disease control purposes.
You came in a little broken up, but I guess what I was leading up to is it seems like early on, like now, there ought to be some requirements that they have to test their animals, you know, and at least if some, especially the reindeer farmers, because they move them around at Christmas time all over the state and actually the Northwest. But my other question about crowding really came down to one thing I noticed that, you know, you talked about, and I think it was wise, about banning baiting for hunting deer and elk and no recreational feeding. Of course, if we could further no recreational feeding, that would also help us with wildlife conflict in general. But my question is, because knowing of the debate for like 30 years in Yellowstone and the Tetons, is feedlots. And, you know, I'm surprised that in your early initial phasing, like right now, we don't also do some susceptibility testing in the feedlots. And I would think that as soon as you see it within 10 miles of the border, that practice would be stopped immediately. Personally, I think it should be stopped now, but, you know, I didn't hear anything about the feedlots, and that's such a controversial area in other states for so many years. I was wondering, you know, what your thinking is on that.
Yeah, and so we do address this a little bit in our plan. We recognize that, yes, that practice will, if CWD is found there, will increase transmission of the disease and prevalence. We have to remember, though, that, you know, CWD is one issue in all these populations. So we have to balance different management strategies and different issues with this disease. So while it's, you know, feeding and baiting is known to increase transmission rates of this disease and other diseases, there are other reasons why we might be feeding animals. So we don't specifically outline exactly what we would do in the plan, but we recognize this as an area that we will have to address specifically in regards to our practices of feeding elk. So,
I'll just summarize. My suggestion would be that it would be better to incorporate it sooner than later so that when something happens, you know, it's sort of in the plan, you know, even if it's phased in. But I think it's been such a controversial issue that kind of being silent on it, you know, might not be your best strategy. So just an opinion. Thanks a lot.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks, Amelia. Brock?
Yeah, I just wanted to acknowledge that I think we agree absolutely. And that's going to be a big topic in, you know, the Yakima Canyon area, where that's the only place that we have an active feeding program. And there's gonna be a lot of differing opinions on that. And it's gonna require local engagement, you know, with agricultural producers, with other land management agencies, with our hunters. And I think once our CWD plan that's really gonna be a catalyst for us to start having that conversation. And what do we do, you know, once we get a positive detection, and how do we move forward with that feeding program?
Thanks. Molly, go ahead.
I had to step out for a little bit. So if either of these questions are a repeat, I will be happy to get the answers offline. So I apologize in advance. My first question is, how are the salvage permits used to get samples? Is it on the permit now? I'm just curious about that. And then my second question is, what kind of working relationship do we have with the State Department of Agriculture on CWD?
Yeah, so I will answer your first question. So we currently do not have anything on the salvage permit related to sample collection. So in our plan, we propose that we will revisit the salvage permit process, and we would like to see that somewhere within that process, either we have salvage tag holders voluntarily submit a sample and figure out that process, or make it a mandatory process if you're going to salvage a deer or elk. But those conversations still need to be had. But as of right now, currently, there's nothing on the salvage tag permit that is related to sample collection. Relationship with Department of Ag. We did give them our plan. I forget if we got, Brock, can you answer this question? Did we get
hand up? Malia, maybe Eric, do you want to say something?
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn. Not specifically on the response to the plan, so we may need to get back to Brock on that, but just very quickly, I've been wanting to interject that we've had some comments around like the increased resource need and some of this work and engagement, say, with, you know, captive cervid industry and Department of Ag now. So I just wanted to point out, we don't have anything conclusive yet, but we've been working with Senator Muzzall in the budget development for this biennium to try to get some additional resources that would allow us to get into a serious, significant surveillance and monitoring program, you know, by this fall, starting this fall. So we're very hopeful that that's going to happen. We have some indication that we might see some of that in proviso language when budgets come out shortly, but we don't know for sure yet. So it's really premature, just kind of something we're watching and have our finger on that pulse. In working with the senator on that language, we included not only that those funds would be very useful and needed for the surveillance and monitoring, but we recognize this public engagement component. We didn't go so far as to get what we would need for all of the human dimensions work that's covered in the plan. That's got a, you know, substantial price tag to it, and it is very important, but we knew we needed to get to surveillance and monitoring. and we knew we needed to get to public engagement. And so part of our draft language that we provided included work with an advisory group that would involve folks from the, say, the cervid, live cervid community, as well as specifically holding a place available for Department of Agriculture engagement with the department on this very issue. So we're hopeful and waiting to see what comes out in the budgets and the end of the legislative session this year that we'll have some funding to address some of these things.
Thanks, Eric. Jim?
Yes.
Molly, was that okay?
Yeah, I just, you know, because I engage with the Department of Ag a lot, you know, I feel like they're talking about this issue quite a bit and have done quite a bit of work on it. And I would just hate to miss that opportunity to combine information and resources on this topic. So I guess I would just encourage us to continue to reach out to them if that's not already happening.
Great, thank you. Brock, before Jim goes, you have your hand up.
Yeah, I would just add that, you know, I think we can say that conversation, Molly, is already being had. So, you know, there's a nexus even between some of our rules and the Department of Ag's rules, right? So they, if we have someone move to the state and they want to bring in cervids into the state that we allow, Department of Ag rules are actually what they have to follow first. So they've got to go through testing. We have frequent conversations with the Department of Ag about our reindeer facilities that we currently do have, captive facilities. So I think there's going to be ready conversations being had, and they're going to be a clear partner to move forward with anything with CWD.
That is exactly what I was getting at. So that makes me feel a lot better to hear that, Brock. Thank you.
Great, thanks. Okay, Jim.
Yeah, just basically a question about the plan and the authority to adopt, who adopts, the extent, the time frames associated with that. I guess the question is, you know, is this a department plan or is this something that the commission needs to take up officially? And maybe related to that is the issue of expected or possible commission actions that will need to be taken or need to be considered over the next, you know, 12 months or so. So kind of a scoping of that as well. So a couple questions embedded in that statement.
Yeah, I see Eric with his hand up, I think. Go ahead, Eric.
Thank you, Commissioner Thorburn and Anderson. Great question. You know, I don't know that we've drilled down on who would actually sign off on the plan, but my impression would be that it is a department plan, but certainly the commission could weigh in what type of ownership you wanted to have with the plan itself or perhaps any policy development around the plan. Just a reminder, you know, you're getting the first kind of public view of this draft plan. We recognize there's a lot of work ahead of us. You heard the words that were our recommendation is, you heard that frequently throughout the presentation today, but we're certainly not recommending any vote by any commission at this time on any WAC changes. So our goal is to engage the public, continue to engage the Wildlife Committee and the commission, you know, as appropriate to finalize this draft plan, put it into a formal implementation phase. And that will then include numerous touch points with the commission that the commission clearly would own from the public process on consideration of changes to WACs. You brought up salvage deer, you know, the permits as an example, and we heard several others. So, you know, that my thought would be that it would be a department owned plan through a public process with commission and committee engagement, and you could interact how you choose to or policy around that. And then you will definitely have that oversight role when there's regulation being considered.
Thanks. Lorna?
Just quickly, I'm assuming that that would include SEPA review for such a far-reaching plan with, yeah, I see Brock nodding his head.
Yes, we do have SEPA review as part of our public comment process.
Thank you. Just one quick question. We talked a little bit more about additional surveillance among captive populations. What about our rehabilitators? Have they been considered for doing surveillance?
Actually, I'll let Kristen talk about rehabilitation. She'll probably do a much better job than me.
I don't know. So only fawns pretty much are rehabilitated, not adult deer. They just don't do well in rehabilitation situations. And with fawns, the disease, it really can't be detected in anything younger than, say, about a yearling. Malia, correct me if I'm wrong on that, but you can't even, the prions don't build up enough to be able to be detected until the deer reach a certain age. So there's really not a good way to do surveillance based on deer fawns.
Okay.
If I could quickly add, though, there is certainly a nexus, and we want to understand our rehabbers' activities and when they do release and where they release. We already have guidance on where and when that should occur with cervids, and those might be things we would revisit. So in addition to your question about surveillance, there is the very real question about how rehab facilities operate and what they would do with deer and potential cervid movement.
Thanks. Malia, I see you've got your hand.
Yeah, I'll clarify a little bit. We have detected CWD in fawns, but it's probably, like Kristen said, a combination of prion accumulation not occurring, so potentially missing those early detections, but also because this is a chronic disease, it's likely that prevalence is also really is low in fawns as well in that age class. So we do know fawns can test positive.
So it could be an indicator. Anis?
Yeah, I just wanted to stress that even though we can ask for rehabilitators to test, there's currently not a good live test. And so it would be difficult, I guess, without euthanizing the animal. And at that point, it's a moot point, I guess, if they're a rehabilitator. So we are going to discourage rehabilitation of cervids in those areas where we think CWD is likely to come in. And so I guess with those two prongs, I think it makes it a little bit more safe. But yeah, it's right now as it stands, there are some live tests, but they're not highly reliable.
Yeah, they did mention our collared deer, so I figured there was probably a live test. Kristen, you have your hand up.
I just want to thank Malia and Anise for following up and doing a better job of answering the question about fawns. But I did also want to say that when we recently redid our rehabilitation wax a few years ago, we did restrict the movement of fawns, and we tried to keep it within the region where they originated, and they can only be released in the region where they originated. And a big part of the reason we did that was out of concerns of CWD and deer fawns being moved back and forth across the state. So we have engaged with the rehabbers on that, and it's reflected in updates to the rehab wax.
Great. Thanks, Kristen. Well, I don't see any other hands, so I'll assume that for now questions are answered and the time is getting late. So thank you so much, Malia, Kristen, and Sarah, and everyone else who participated. This has been really informative, and we look forward to moving forward with this and staying in touch on it. So with that, we're way past time, formally adjourned, but Eric does have this video to share with us. So Eric, go ahead. And once you're done, we'll be closed.
Thank you. And thanks, everybody. And thank you to the presenters. Wonderful, wonderful job, Malia. I learn every time I hear your presentation. So thanks. And thanks for the authors. Yes, I am going to share a video. It's just over 13 minutes. It's called the Predator Prey Project. And I just wanted the commission and the public watching today to have a first opportunity to see this. It will be available for the public, you know, as a, in total here very soon. This is kind of an overview that was pulled together to talk about the, you know, approximately 5-year project that the department's been involved in regarding predator prey. And you're going to learn about that in the video, so I won't go into great detail. But we took the opportunity as this video was being developed to also shoot a video that was on wolf monitoring and surveillance, which you have seen. It's available now. So we kind of dovetailed or piggybacked that effort on top of this effort, which was the main reason we contracted with the company to do this work. So just going to hopefully things will go smoothly. I'm going to share my screen and the sound here and play the video, and I hope you enjoy it. If somebody could give me an indicator if you have it yet.
We can see it.
Yeah.
You can. Okay.
Yeah.
And here we go.
We can hear it too.
So fundamentally, the Predator Prey Project is trying to answer what seems to be a relatively straightforward question, which is, what are the impacts of wolves and predation in general on various ungulate populations in landscapes with people? But there's a lot more that goes into that than just, you know, a simple who's eating who sort of thing.
The Washington Predator Prey Project was started as a legislative mandate in 2016. Our agency was asked to conduct research looking at the effects of wolf predation on the ungulate populations in Washington state. And we're working together with the University of Washington.
They're looking at it.
Serving in the legislature, you're only as good as the information that you can get. You know, we've had questions over the years, you know, how are our ungulates doing? You know, what are the populations of moose, elk, deer? People are interested in that in this part of the country. And then we've got some new predators moving in. Well, let's get some good science on it.
Initially, it was just sort of, what are the impacts of wolves? And we said, okay, well, we can answer that. But if you really want to know, you can't just leave it at wolves.
It's a cat.
You have to understand what other carnivores are doing to ungulate populations, and you have to understand how those ungulate populations are competing with one another and how those carnivore populations are competing with one another. And then, to make things extra special complicated, you have to incorporate that human element.
Wolves in Washington are recolonizing in working landscapes. They're not recolonizing these pristine park-like settings. They're recolonizing areas where people live, where they work, and where they recreate. And so we know that we can't take the lessons learned from Yellowstone and apply them here in Washington. We know it's going to be different.
With the Predator Prey Project, there are two study areas.
In the Northeast study area, we've got a wolf population that's well established. We're in the Okanagan, they're on what we call the colonizing front. We can then answer questions not just of who's eating who and where and how often, but what's the impact when there's fewer wolves versus more wolves?
Right now, we are trying to catch white-tailed deer, specifically using clover traps, which are these big contraptions right here. The goal of this winter field work is to catch white-tailed deer so that we can put GPS tracking collars on them and understand how they're moving around and what their rates and causes of mortality are.
Are you guys ready? Get up. Go, go, go. Go, go, go. Dragon. How is she? Okay. Whenever we're processing that animal, the main thing is getting the radio collar on it. The other thing we do is we ear tag them, so they each get a unique numbered ear tag. We also take blood samples. And then we actually will check for pregnancy in the field.
Is that a heartbeat?
These collars check in. We know when that animal is alive.
There she goes.
But the other side of it is it notifies us when they die.
When the workload picks up for me is when the deer are collared, and then we get the occasional mortality, and I've got to go out and find it. It's really fun to play detective. You know, when you get in on a site and you've got to really dig in, so to speak, to figure out what the mortality source was.
Coming up, here we go. Hopefully they're below the fog bank here. There's one. Oh, yeah. I think that's the collar.
I think so. You can probably get on it. Take a look.
It sounds like it.
Darn it.
Nice job, guys.
The whole project is trying to understand how is the return of wolves going to affect deer and elk in the state of Washington? And we want to understand wolf-cougar interactions. Are wolves and cougars using these same areas or not? Are they competing for deer and elk in the same places or not? That is really one of the unanswered questions.
Yesterday, you got to check a bunch of empty traps with me, which when you're trying to trap cougars or wolves or anything like that, you do a lot of. You need to make sure that everything is exactly as it should be so that when that opportunity presents itself, you give yourself the greatest chance of catching that animal. From the moment I pull the trigger and the dart strikes the cat to when we're done collecting data, it's usually 40 minutes. I usually examine their teeth and measure their teeth because for a carnivore, teeth are everything.
How's he doing, Lucas?
Teeth tell you a tremendous amount of information about the condition and the age of the animal. And then we take a whole suite of measurements, we weigh them. From there, you give them the reversal and it's on its way and doing its part for science.
In the most simple sense, GPS collars tell us where wolves and cougars are eating food. We'll see a bunch of locations in the same spot, which we call a cluster. And either the animal's resting there or they've stopped to eat something. We'll hike out to the center of those points. And we can actually find out if that was indeed a feeding site versus a bed site and what was eaten. What was the species, age, and sex of that food item?
Camera trapping seems like it would be easy, but we randomly pick locations across the landscape, which can be miles and miles and miles off trail up on top of a giant mountain. And then you can spend literally hours trying to get the camera set up just right so that it's going to trigger on anything from, you know, a bobcat to a moose. A really powerful thing that the camera traps bring to this project that maybe the GPS collars can't is that the cameras are monitoring, you know, one spot for a long period of time. You'll get pictures of every single animal that comes to that spot.
Card number C76.
So the data that we're collecting comes in all forms. So we're getting fine scale location data of each individual animal, which can be hundreds of thousands of points on the landscape. We're also collecting data about each individual's life history. So how old is this individual? Did this animal die? What was the cause of mortality? Is it predation? Or is it roadkill? Or is it disease? So all this information that we collect goes into models, basically, that form an idea of what is actually influencing the population as a whole.
To me, the Predator-Prey Project matters because it's more information so I can do my job better. You know, I'm tasked with managing the wildlife, specifically in District 1, for the people of the state of Washington.
Most people I talk to are not only willing to let me put a camera on their property, but really excited about it. And I think it's a really cool component of this project that we're getting to know so many people in these communities and seeing how invested they are in the landscape, in the animals, and then in the management and conservation of those things.
That's, I think, the biggest thing that can come out of this is balance between predators and prey and also with the people that live here. And there's a balance that can be found. We just haven't got there yet. And I'm hopeful. Guardedly hopeful, but hopeful.
I mean, ultimately, that's who this information goes to in the end, is it goes to the public. We manage and conserve wildlife and trust for them, right? And so that's our ultimate obligation, is to do the best science we possibly can, to get the best information we possibly can, to really make sure that both people and wildlife thrive into the future.
All right. Well, there you have it. I think Kim said we would be concluded after the end of the video. So I think we need to leave it at that. But I think it's a wonderful piece of work.
Thanks, Eric.
Great job.